All right, welcome back, Crossover NBA Podcast. On this episode, we dive deep into the James Harden drama down in Houston. Michael Shapiro does a great job covering the Rockets for SI.com. We peel back some of the layers on this, from what James Harden is thinking, being a late arrival to camp, what the Rockets are thinking with the Harden drama kind of consuming them, and who might the suitors be for Harden. We know Brooklyn's out there, Philadelphia. Are there other possibilities? I dive into that and much more with Michael Shapiro. A little bit later on, Sarah Kustok does a great job covering the NBA for the Yes Network, for FS1, NBA Radio. I talked to Sarah about her day job covering the Nets, specifically how this Nets team is going to coalesce. On paper, they have as much talent as anybody else's, but as we know, games aren't won on paper, and bad things can happen to teams with too much talent sometimes in this league. So I talked to her about that. Plus, Russell Westbrook in Washington. How do we expect Westbrook and Beal to play together, and what should the expectations be for the Wizards as they begin the post-John Wall era? As always, best way to support this podcast, get over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, on to the show.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, so a lot going on in Houston right now. You've got Russell Westbrook out, John Wall in, James Harden in. For now, we'll see what happens with that in the coming days. Talk about that and much more. Let's bring in Michael Shapiro. He does a great job covering the Rockets for SI.com. And Mike, let's set the table here. James Harden is back in Houston. That much we know. According to multiple reports, Harden has to test negative 6 consecutive days in order to return to Rockets practice. According to the Houston Chronicle's Jonathan Fagan, while that is not bad, it's also not terrible. Harden was unlikely to join the Rockets on this upcoming trip to Chicago anyway, and Houston's first practice after that is on Monday, putting Harden on track, I guess, to participate. All of this, however, is against the backdrop of Harden effectively showing up his team by posting pictures on Instagram of himself at a birthday party in Atlanta the last couple of days. That has left his new coach, Stephen Silas, with the all but impossible task of explaining the absence of a player that he has virtually no relationship with. So I guess I'll ask you, for in a broad sense, where are we right now with James Harden and the Rockets?
Yeah, you know, I think the Rockets are really just happy right now that he is here. You know, I think there is a bit of annoyance. You know, you could tell from Stephen Silas that, you know, there was some bit understandable displeasure with James Harden's absence. But at this point, you know, I think professionalism is the most important. That's something kind of Stephen Silas has stressed, that what really matters now is getting ready for the season. And it seems like the Rockets are determined to start the year, you know, with James Harden on their roster, play it out from there. And then, you know, we'll certainly see where things go in the coming weeks and months.
I think the question now, because we know James Harden wants out, you know, whether it's to Brooklyn or somebody else, and we'll get to some of the possibilities a little bit later on. My question is, how far is James Harden willing to take this? He's got 2 guaranteed years left in his contract with a player option for a third. He's already turned down an extension that would have made him the NBA's first $50 million per year player. He is in a tough spot if he wants to try to force his way out, but he's already kind of, you know, kind of pulled the levers that he can push, Mike, at this point, where he's shown up late and he's leaked out there. His team has leaked out there where he might want to be traded to. I guess your opinion, like, how far might James Harden take this? I mean, he's back in Houston. Could we see him skip out on practices? Could we see him sulk through these practices? I mean, how far do you think he's going to take this?
You know, I think in terms of, you know, not suiting up, I don't really think that's something he's going to do. You know, I think he kind of made his point by showing up late. But when the season rolls around, I think, you know, James Harden's kind of a modern day Iron Man right now. You know, he's an intense competitor. I don't really see him sitting out missing regular season games. I also can certainly see him stating his displeasure, perhaps publicly. You know, it kind of depends on the situation there. But I think it's kind of a balance here where Harden and his camp will try to keep some pressure on Houston to make a deal happen sooner than later. But I kind of also think that right now Harden understands that a trade isn't imminent. The Rockets are more in the exploratory stages than anything. And he's probably going to have to suit up and play a few games and put on at least somewhat of a good face in order for the Rockets to be more willing to trade him, I think.
Look, my understanding is that the Rockets are hoping that, you know, John Wall is as healthy as he says he is, that he's able to play at a high level right away to start the season. And look, Wall said, look, I've been ready to go since March. You know, I was, you know, participating in full practices, and I wrote about Wall this week for SI.com. And, you know, guys will say what they're going to say sometimes, but he seems to be pretty adamant that he's all the way back in terms of health, and he's not going to have any ill effects from the Achilles injury. They've, you know, I don't know if they've upgraded, but they've added people. They've added Christian Wood, who was a decent player in Detroit last year. DeMarcus Cousins, they're taking a flyer on him. My sense, Mike, is that they're hoping that they, if they get off to a fast start, that the displeasure Harden's feeling right now will fade away. Now, I think that might be wishful thinking. I think Harden's got it in his head that, you know, he wants to chase a championship somewhere else. But that's my sense. It's my read on what the Rockets are kind of hoping for. What's yours?
Yeah, you know, I think wishful thinking or maybe even public posturing might be the best way to put it. You know, I think there is a part of the Rockets that thinks, yeah, maybe we can kind of reel things back in here, but I think it would take a really hot start. Now, John Wall, as you said, is pretty healthy, but I think ultimately this, you know, after the end of this season, probably more likely the deadline, I'd be pretty surprised if they were able to kind of change James Harden's mind so drastically. It would take a real interesting turn of events, and, you know, maybe they come out and start hot. But I really think even in that scenario, that's not going to be enough to change Harden's mind here. So it might take a few months, but I don't think there's any reversal coming on Harden's position.
You know, what's interesting is that the way I look at this is that James Harden is partially responsible for the mess that the Rockets are in right now. I mean, Harden was, you know, part of the reason, you know, 50% of it, let's say, that the Harden-Chris Paul pairing didn't work, that it needed to be broken up at the end of the year. They clearly were not comfortable with each other as teammates. And then Harden goes to bat for Russell Westbrook, prompting the Rockets to go probably a little bit too deep into their well of assets to go get Westbrook out of Oklahoma City. And after 1 year, that doesn't work. So, I mean, how much responsibility do you think Harden bears in all this?
You know what? I think it is pretty significant responsibility, to be honest. And as you said, you know, he was really kind of the driving force behind the acquisition of Russell Westbrook. That doesn't work for varying reasons. And then they foot for John Wall. And I understand from Harden's perspective that that's not a perfect situation considering Wall's injury history. But, you know, he kind of engineered this failed Westbrook experiment. And really, more importantly, for the greater part of a decade, you know, the franchise has been engineered around him in really every way. Now, that's borne great results. He's been an amazing player. But I think he has to understand that while, you know, he might want to chase a greener pasture, this is the situation he created for himself. So, you know, an immediate exit isn't going to be automatically guaranteed. You know, I think he does have somewhat of a right, I would say, to tell the Rockets he would prefer them to explore destinations. But the kind of things where you're not showing up to training camp on time and you're kind of jet setting around the country, I think that kind of did irk the Rockets. And, you know, I think he is kind of shirking his responsibility to a degree.
Well, I mean, it should irk the Rockets. You know, yes. If you, I mean, he's, you know, in my mind, I mean, look, this is a tough thing to do, but like he was pretty close to breach a contract throughout all this. I mean, he's you know, not showing up, you know, in a timely manner. He has a responsibility there. So I can see why the Rockets would be irked. And you certainly don't want to usurp the authority of a new coach, especially a young one like Steven Silas. You don't want, you know, to make him look like he's totally impotent at that job when he's trying to win over a locker room that does have some veteran faces in there, that has the PJ Tuckers and the Eric Gordons and now DeMarcus Cousins in that mix. So it's just a bad look all the way around. Now, I'm with you. I think James Harden has forced the Rockets' hand, and I think dealing him right now is not necessarily the worst idea in the world. I mean, you did get off the Russell Westbrook contract. You did get an equally bad one back in return, but I think John Wall is a little bit easier to rebuild around than Russell Westbrook is. Wall is a pass-first type of point guard, and having that as your as part of your foundation, I think definitely is a plus if you're the Rockets. But I think you do wait to see what the market will bear in the coming months. I mean, right now, in my mind, Mike, it seems way too early. Unless you get a unbelievable godfather offer from somebody. I don't even know what that is at this point, or what that would even look like. But unless you get that type of offer, you can't deal James Harden. It's almost malpractice to deal James Harden because you have to wait until the dust settles on this kind of strange preseason, early start to the season, get to the deadline, see what contenders are out there that might be willing to shake things up. You've got to create a bidding war amongst teams, in my mind. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think that's really the right call here. You know, the Rockets have signaled both kind of publicly and privately that they're going to slow play the situation and that, you know, they expect James to come and show up and play. And that's something I think will happen. And if, you know, if Harden's in the building and playing, then what's really the rush to move him at all? You know, I think that obviously you don't want to go into next season with him on the roster if you know he's going to walk, but trade deadline or even theoretically you can play out the year. But yeah, there's no rush to trade him if he's going to suit up and play for the team. The kind of Nets package that's being discussed, I think, is something that they should definitely hold off on and do their due diligence in the market, whether it's Philadelphia or whomever might arise. And probably around the deadline, maybe at the end of the year, it could happen. But I really don't think we'll see it, any Harden deal before opening night or anything drastic like that.
So let's run through some of the deals that could be on the table in the first few weeks. And let's start with the Nets because that's the one that's been talked about the most. I mean, Harden's made it pretty clear that he'd like to play in Brooklyn, be reunited with Kevin Durant, chase a championship with the Nets. And the Nets can make a pretty appealing offer. I mean, they check a lot of boxes with some of the assets they have. They can give you, you know, a borderline or a couple of borderline all-stars or a few borderline all-stars to extend it even further when you're talking about Caris LeVert, Spencer Dinwiddie, and Jared Allen. Those are young core pieces that you can build around. They're not nebulous draft picks. And maybe I'm jaded by being in Boston too long, but I'm just so tired of draft picks being assets. I mean, draft picks are nice on paper, but eventually they have to turn into players, right? And, you know, the Celtics haven't exactly cleaned up with all those picks they've had in recent years. So, like, what is the fatal flaw, you think, in that Brooklyn offer? Because on paper, I see, you know, three good players that could be on the move, plus the Nets, for the first time in a decade, have control of all their draft picks, you know, through through 2027. So, you know, they can put some really interesting pieces on the table.
Yeah, you know, it's not the worst offer or the most objectionable one, but I think it's kind of a situation where, you know, in the past decade, Daryl Morey had worked so hard to take the Rockets out of this dreaded middle area. And I kind of think that the Brooklyn package does that right. You know, Spencer Dinwiddie is a guy who is a nice player, but I don't really think is close to an all-star in the West. Plus, you would have to pay him. You know, Jared Allen is a nice center, but, you know, our center is kind of a dime a dozen. I don't think there's enough of a, I guess, headliner asset, which is kind of the issue here for the Rockets, who have postured again, that they want, you know, a real foundational building block plus a hoard of picks. I think that foundational building block is kind of the most important word there. And I don't know if any of those Nets guys, maybe Caris LeVert, but Dinwiddie and Allen, I don't think really cross that threshold into enticing the Rockets enough, at least right now.
Yeah. You know, on the subject of staying out of that middle area, I think there are times that it's bad, but there are also times that it's okay. It's bad when you're a team that's constructed of a bunch of 30-somethings that doesn't have a high ceiling. You know, I look at John Wall, Spencer Dinwiddie, Caris LeVert. That's not a bad backcourt rotation. You throw Jarrett Allen up front, and at least all these pieces, except for Wall, are well under the age of 30, and you can be building around moving forward. Yeah, the finances get tricky because you have to start paying these guys in the years to come, but I don't mind that offer. You're right, it doesn't have the headliner that some other teams might be willing to offer. And that's the next team we want to talk about, and that's Philadelphia. And wouldn't it be fitting if, you know, the guy that acquired James Harden in Houston winds up acquiring him again in Philadelphia, that being Daryl Morey, the guy that, you know, quite frankly, put the Rockets somewhat in this position as well, you know, winds up taking James Harden off their hands before the trade deadline. The Sixers, they have no path to getting James Harden without surrendering Ben Simmons. There's no way to do it. They don't have anywhere close to the type of young pieces. Don't talk to me about Matisse Thybul. Don't talk to me about some of the other guys they have on the roster. It's Ben Simmons or there's no deal. What do you make of that from both sides? I mean, if you're Philadelphia, do you part with Ben Simmons to get James Harden? If you're Houston, is Ben Simmons enough for James Harden, or do you need to get more pieces back in return?
You know, I think it's interesting because it kind of strikes you as the most obvious deal. And the more I think about it, the more it just really makes sense. And I try to talk myself out of it and think of ways in which you'd say no. But, you know, from the Rockets perspective, at least, you know, I think that getting a player like Ben Simmons, you know, and Steven Silas can probably engineer an offense that fully sits around him, right? And plays to his strengths in the best way possible. I think he can be a really destructive player, you know, kind of a perennial all-NBA talent. And you really don't see the kind of superstars who want out traded for those kind of pieces. I think if you can get that for Houston, I think that's huge. From Philadelphia's perspective, I understand the point that Simmons is considerably younger, right? He has 3 more years left on his contract if you don't get a commitment from Harden. So there is the question there, but if you feel some urgency, I think that James Harden is at this point a markedly better player than Ben Simmons. You know, I think that Philly would not be apt to trade a lot of other assets as well as Simmons for Harden. But I think this is a deal where both sides, there is some considerable risk involved, but I think it would make both sense for both parties. And I think for the Rockets, it's their best option if they can pull that off.
Yeah, I mean, Simmons is under contract through 2025. So you're not worried about, you know, this type of scenario popping up anytime soon. You've got a Simmons John Wall backcourt, which is, you know, makes you clutch up the Southwest with your agency. But it you'd be fast, that's for sure. You could be dominant in transition. And John, and look, I think Simmons, while his best position is at point guard, you know, you can certainly hide him in different spots on the floor and make him a primary ball handler in certain situations. And a creative coach can do something with that. So I think that's a, if that were ever on the table, and I think Philadelphia is a team that's not going to be in the mix for James Harden until we get to the trade deadline. The moves that Daryl Morey has made, you know, shedding the contract and the player that is Al Horford, moving off of some of their non-shooters like Josh Richardson, adding guys like Danny Green into that mix, adding Seth Curry into that mix. That tells me that they'd like to see what this team looks like with quality shooting around Simmons and around Joel Embiid. I mean, Daryl's unpredictable. He could, you know, pull the trigger on anything at a moment's notice. And, you know, the next time some GM says, I have no interest in something, I'd like to remind you that Tommy Shepard said that 2 days before dealing away John Wall. So anything could happen, I guess. But I think Philadelphia wants to see what this team looks like with the right pieces around Simmons and Embiid. Because, look, Harden, and you've got a better look at Harden than I have. I think his game is going to age pretty well because he doesn't play above the rim and he plays by drawing contact. It's the free throw line like 10 times per game. I think those are attributes that are going to age pretty well, but he is over the age of 30. And you have to start wondering about, you know, his first step and some of the explosiveness he plays with his game. You know, is that going to age as well as some might think? And the flip side, you have Simmons, who is still very young, just 24 years old, as remarkable as that is, and someone you can still build around for years to come. I feel like that could be a factor in all this, unless you think Harden is going to be, you know, the same player deep into his 30s. And again, you've had a better look at it than I have.
Yeah, I mean, I think Harden's game will age pretty well. I think it's kind of a matter of what Philadelphia considers its best path forward towards title contention. I think, though, what we're going to see here is that there are a lot of factors leading to this situation being drawn out closer to the trade deadline and not really happening soon, right? If the Rockets are not satisfied with the Nets package and the Sixers, you know, really want to see what they have with their young team already, and you don't really see any mystery teams kind of emerging and pushing hard, then it's going to be kind of a protracted situation. And yeah, ultimately it might be a kind of setup where the 76ers are fine and they say, we don't want to make this deal. And kind of the Nets are the only team left on the dance floor. I think that's probably Brooklyn's best path, but Houston's not going to jump at that kind of deal. So I think the situations of all these teams that could be potentially involved point to a situation where Harden's going to log, you know, probably 30 plus games with the Rockets this year, up until the deadline. And that's really, I think, when push might come to shove.
You know, the other interesting team right off the bat is Boston. And the Celtics have been reluctant to, you know, execute any significant deals in recent years. You know, they've been involved probably in more trade talks than any team in the league because of all the assets they have, the young pieces that they've had, but they haven't pulled the trigger. They haven't done it with some big name guys, whether it's Kawhi Leonard a few years back when he was with San Antonio, Anthony Davis, of course, that was well publicized, those discussions. But now here the Celtics are. I mean, and they're a good team. Like, you know, the Celtics are certainly in the mix to get back to or to get to the NBA Finals with this group. But, you know, if a If a Jaylen Brown, Marcus Smart, plus draft picks deal gets the job done for Harden, you got to think about that if you're Boston, don't you? And on the flip side, you've probably got to think about it if you're Houston, because, you know, Jaylen Brown is not Ben Simmons, but I think Jaylen Brown has a few all-star seasons in him. I think he's that good on both ends of the floor. Marcus Smart, you know, one of the top three defensive wing players in this league, and then a bunch of draft picks you can use to rebuild the roster. That, to me, Mike, is appealing on both sides. Now, Boston would kind of veer off, you know, their Jaylen and Jason tract, so to speak, because those guys in their early 20s, you know, they could grow together for at least the next 4 years when both are under contract. But, you know, Harden opens that window right now. And, you know, Harden, Kemba Walker, Jason Tatum, that's a pretty good big three, especially in the Eastern Conference, where, you know, you're competing with Brooklyn and that group, and Milwaukee, of course, is there. I think you need that kind of big three to have any hope of getting out of that conference.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic there because, you know, Boston, they kind of passed on any Kawhi for Jaylen Brown situation, and now the commitment to both Brown, you know, and Tatum is even deeper than it's been when they kind of turned down any Kawhi deal. So now you kind of look at a Harden situation. Is he the guy they'll pull the trigger for? Of course, he has one more year left than Kawhi did. You know, I think from the Rockets' perspective, I think it's probably something they would go ahead and pull the trigger on just because Jaylen Brown, I feel like he's such a steadying force for an organization. He's a guy you can kind of bank on for a decade of quality basketball. And I think for a team that has had some kind of tumultuous situation in recent years, I think that would be a nice presence. Marcus Smart, I think he would be a very effective player. And if you need to deal him, that's probably a way to pick up another first-round pick as well. So I think what we're seeing here is that there are going to be more suitors than just the Nets, as people kind of originally assumed, or it was kind of intended, I think, perhaps by James Harden's camp, that the Rockets are going to do their due diligence. Maybe it's Boston, Philadelphia, perhaps a Western Conference team like the Clippers if we really wanted to get crazy. But this is going to be a more expansive market than just the Nets, and I think Boston is, you know, a pretty sensible play.
Yeah, I think one factor in all this that the Rockets have to wait to see play out is, you know, what happens with Giannis and that contract extension. And Giannis, you know, said on Wednesday he wasn't thinking about it, so there's no real indication yet he's going to sign it. But what if he does sign an extension before December 21st? And that puts other teams in play, teams that might have been clearing cap space for the summer of 2021. And the team I'm looking at right now is Miami. And, you know, look, and if you're the Heat, you know, you're not giving up Bam Adebayo. Like, that's just not happening. But might you package, you know, Tyler Hero in and some other pieces to see if that can interest Houston? I mean, I think that's certainly possible. And Miami is as good as any team in the league at kind of wheeling and dealing and, you know, finding ways to make things work under the salary cap. That's another team I think you keep an eye on as this thing advances. If Giannis signs that contract extension, or even if he doesn't, I guess, if the Heat have a chance to get James Harden without, you know, breaking up the, I don't even know what the core would be, Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo, but I think those two guys are probably off the table. Anybody else, I think, would be in play.
Yeah, I think the Hero is definitely an interesting name that's been floated kind of theoretically, and that would make sense. You know, I think certainly for Miami, they've cleared all this cap space, yes, for Giannis, but, you know, you honestly are just clearing the cap space for a max guy, right? It doesn't have to specifically be Giannis Antetokounmpo coming up here. I think that would be a smart call, and, you know, I think Harden would, you know, it's kind of an interesting idea with Harden and quote unquote Heat culture, but I think Eric Spoelstra would find a way to have him fit in right away. You know, he's really never played with a big quite like Bam Adebayo. I think from a pure basketball standpoint, that would be a really amazing fit. And Jimmy Butler is, you know, kind of a co-star on the wing who doesn't really need the ball to initiate the offense. Harden could really take a lot of point guard responsibilities. And yeah, maybe Miami will dangle enough out there. Maybe Tyler Hero is enough of a headliner, though, you know, I might be a little skeptical there. But it's just really hard to parse just how much Houston will be able to squeeze out of this market. I think that time is on their side, but when it gets to the deadline, you know, perhaps it'll be a situation where Brooklyn's the only team left. But it's fun to kind of knock around these possibilities for the next few months.
Well, that's the other thing, too. Like, I love Tyler Hero, but I don't know if he gets you there with James Harden. Like,
right. Yeah.
Like, he had a great rookie year, and I think he's going to be a high-level starter in this league for a long time. But he only, you know, took over that starting role in the bubble. I mean, Kendrick Nunn was the starter for that team for most of the season. So I don't know if you can make the leap that Tyler Hero is enough. But I'm with you on the fit. I mean, look, the Heat have managed to incorporate successfully, I should add, Hassan Whiteside, Dion Waiters. I mean, they've taken on a lot of quote-unquote problem childs in this league and made the best of it. Jimmy Butler was a problem child for a long time. You know, it's just finding the right fit and finding the right culture to make it work. And I think Harden would be fine. And I agree with you that the Harden and Bam Adebayo on pick and rolls, then Butler and Bam Adebayo. And I mean, that's a tough team to guard. That is a really tough team to guard. And the way they'll undoubtedly defend, even with Harden there, like that would, they might instantly become the favorite in the Eastern Conference ahead of a team like Brooklyn and ahead of a team like Milwaukee as well. So
yeah, I would probably agree with that. And, you know, I think one more point on the Rockets is I kind of think that Hero falls into that kind of, as the headliner, falls into the Caris LeVert and Dinwiddie range. And that's, again, the problem that the Rockets might run into. If those are kind of the best players available, if Philly backs out, then we'll see what their options are, because the package, if it's not Philadelphia, I think might be a little more disappointing than certain Rockets fans would hope.
You know, look, the other thing too is, even if this didn't happen, if things hadn't disintegrated to the point where they are, trading Harden is probably the right call anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not going to win a championship with this team. It's just not going to happen. You might be able to get to the second round, but is that your goal every single year, to get to the second round until the wheels have fallen off James Harden? I don't think so. I mean, I've always said on this podcast, I've written it, being proactive is better than being reactive. The teams that are proactive are generally a lot more successful than the teams that are reactive. On Russell Westbrook, the Rockets had to be reactive. He didn't want to be there. The trade market was nil. They basically had to take on one distressed asset to get rid of another. James Harden is not a distressed asset. James Harden is a guy that teams will bend over backwards and try to create as many assets as possible to interest Houston in a deal like that. Trading him and bringing young pieces back, whether it is a Jaylen Brown, Marcus Smart package, a Tyler Hero plus package, even the Brooklyn package, like that at least puts the Rockets on a more logical track, don't you think? I mean, it doesn't, right now they just seem like a team that's trying to grasp on to a second round exit. And that doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense to me, no matter what the situation is. Like that doesn't really line up with what a successful team should be thinking about.
You know, I think the issue that the Rockets have kind of run into here is again, it's by their own design. It's by James Harden's design, where, you know, if they hadn't engineered this Chris Paul trade and they had a lot of those first round picks still, you know, maybe this summer, right, they would be able to deal Paul and picks for other pieces if they needed to, or they would be able to, you know, kind of build the current team with those assets specifically. But then they burn them for Westbrook. Obviously, they couldn't get any real assets back other than Wall and a straight swap. So the room for improvement for the team is still kind of shaky. And I think, you know, they might have a nice regular season. I'm kind of encouraged by Christian Wood. John Wall does look healthy. But there is a ceiling on this team. And that is a ceiling that was, again, as you noted, kind of created by their own team here, which is kind of, I think, part of the frustration that maybe some of the front office or Steven Silas might have, that, you know, James Harden engineered this team to kind of burn their war chest, and then that experiment didn't work, and now he's asking out. That's kind of a tough progression to swallow if you're the Rockets.
I just can't get excited about Christian Wood. I can't do it. I can't bring myself to buy into a player that has a half a season's worth of work on an awful team as his resume. I can't do it. Like, he just, the guy's gonna have to show me he can play both ends. He's gonna have to show me he can score, you know, against frontline defenses on a team that's trying to win something. Maybe if the Rockets do deal Harden and they become like a mediocre team, he'll still put up numbers. But that's one of those guys, and I took some heat on social media for it, for suggesting the contract was bogus. But like, I can't get on board with that. Look, Detroit had one of the dumbest off seasons in recent memory, like with some of the moves they made. And they still didn't re-sign Christian Wood. They still didn't want him there. Like, that to me is like a major red flag. If the Pistons are like overpaying Jeremy Grant and Mason Plumlee and don't want Christian Wood and what's being viewed as a logical, reasonable contract, that's got to set off some red flags somewhere, doesn't it? Like, you got to start thinking, like, 3 years, was it $41 million for Christian Wood? And like,
exactly.
You think the Pistons knew something, maybe? Like, they didn't want to do that? I don't know.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to kind of parse the Pistons thinking at all. And I understand it was a very small sample, right? He played 62 games last year, 21 minutes a game. But he was incredibly
efficient. It was really after, you have to look at the post Drummond trade stats. Like, that's right. Where
he really took off
those numbers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certainly, you know, he is a talented guy. I think that, again, the thing that is I think encouraging in this scenario is that Steven Silas is going to put him in a position to succeed, at least offensively. You know, I really can't speak to his defensive acumen. It's not like he's going to, you know, earn any All-NBA teams. He might be a net negative on that end. But I think this Rockets team, if John Wall is healthy, is going to score, and Wood's going to put up some nice numbers. Now you could kind of quibble with the impact that'll have on the team, and maybe those numbers are inflated when the Rockets do, in fact, trade James Harden. But that contract might be a little better, I think, than you're giving it credit for.
Maybe the contract is okay. I just think that, you know, there are a lot of people in Houston that were just blown away by the Christian Wood sign.
Like, head over heels, yes.
Like, just wild. Like, I don't get that. Like, even if you knew nothing about him, he had one season, half a season, really, of putting up numbers on a bad team. Those guys should terrify you. They should terrify you. Or at the very least, those guys should make you modify your expectations. Like, if you want Christian Wood to be, like, a 12 to 15 point per game scorer on a decent team, all right. I have heard some horror stories about his defense in Detroit and how he contributed on that end of the floor. But if you want him to be an offensive presence, I think he can do that. It's just when it gets to winning time, I don't know that he's the answer and at either front court spot.
You know, we'll see if he even gets a chance to play in that kind of, as you said, you know, kind of big spot, or if the Rockets will be using him as one of their pieces in the rebuild. I guess that kind of depends on what they'll do here in the coming months with Harden.
You're right about the Wall part of it, though. Like, if Wall's healthy, he's going to create a lot of easy opportunities for guys that can run the floor, and Christian Wood can run the floor. Like, he is a athletic, mobile, big man. I think he'll get opportunities that way. And I guess that's, you know, kind of full circle. What is John Wall, and how well is he going to play this season? Well, I'm sure we'll be revisiting this, Mike, at some point in the coming days and months. Until then, man, thanks for joining me, and good luck on the James Harden beat down in Houston.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
All right, Sarah Kustok is here, Nets analyst for the YES Network, NBA analyst for FS1, NBA Radio, and Illinois Basketball Coaches Association Hall of Fame inductee. I mean, that's top line, right, Sarah?
You know what? You took me by surprise, Mannix. Not that you don't typically, but in our pre-chat, you didn't bring it up, so I thought we were just going to be able to smooth right by.
Well, I mean, you did tweet about it and then retweeted other people tweeting you about it, so clearly this is a source of great pride for you.
You know what? It is. It is. I don't like to talk about myself, as you know, but I have great pride for where I came from and the places that I played in my high school and growing up in Chicago and playing at DePaul. So yes, it was my public display of gratitude for all those people and all those places.
I'm sure.
And it's been, and like, it's so long ago, most people don't even think I ever played basketball.
I'm sure your friends at the YES Network will have a nice highlight package for the next broadcast of Kustok's greatest hits in the DePaul.
No, I think that's
areas.
I think we retired it. We had a hot stove show, and I think that's where it ends.
Fair enough. Let's talk about the Nets here for a minute. Brooklyn, like, on paper, you can make a strong argument the Nets are the best team in the league. When I was reporting my story this week on John Wall, I got some insight into, you know, what Kevin Durant is right now, because he spent some time scrimmaging with Wall. And all the people I talked to that watched those scrimmages or part of those scrimmages said Kevin was the best player on the floor by far. Like, it wasn't even close. So I'm going into the season, Sarah, under the assumption that Kevin Durant is coming back as Kevin Durant. I wouldn't pick him as MVP because I'm sure the Nets will be cautious with him with some of these quirks in the schedule, but I think he's going to have an MVP caliber year. Kyrie is Kyrie. We know what he can do on the floor. The depth, we know what that is with Dinwiddie and Allen and Caris LeVert. Joe Harris adds shooting. There doesn't seem to be many holes on this roster, at least on paper. As you look at the Nets and you've kind of studied them, you know, more intensely over the last few weeks as this has kind of gotten going, where are the flaws? Like, where do you see the bumps, the potential bumps for this team?
I think it all begins with how they coalesce. And when you look at the roster, and I think you nailed all the main points, how does this team come together? And what I'm really curious and anxious to see, and we may get a taste of it as the preseason games start coming along, with the approach that Steve Nash said he and his coaching staff will take of in ways, you know, really treating it as a understanding and a feel for how they're going to utilize the roster. But how do you mix and match these guys? What rosters are you playing with? I mean, and I wouldn't necessarily say that those are holes or weaknesses, but I think they have the versatility to play in a lot of different ways, you know, and put guys in a multitude of positions. So I think figuring that out, working that out, and making sure guys are understanding their roles and how that changes and how that varies is going to be a big part of it. And you mentioned everything you talk about. A lot of it, I think we predicate and think about the offensive end and just what dominant forces some of these players are, the stars are, and how they will open things up for the depth and the rest of the team. This is something I think when, you know, now as you start to think about a variety of other teams, it's often a question mark, but how are they going to look on the defensive end and where are some of those areas that you can still make sure that you are finding ways to stop teams? Because it's not like you're talking about, you know, competing into the playoffs. When you're truly talking about championship aspirations, that end of the floor matters. And so when you have your star player and Kevin Durant, who has been excellent at that end, but him coming back from injury, does the Achilles affect him a little bit more on that end? So when you start to go down the list, how they play, what we've heard out of the team and out of Steve Nash is that they're doing some very unique things on the defensive end. I don't know what that means. I'm curious. And we've had some players say they, you know, they're seeing things that they have not for as much as in the league, you see so many similarities across teams. They are seeing things, implementing things that they have not seen before. So I'm curious and I'm excited to see what exactly that means and how that plays out.
So if you want to kind of play devil's advocate and look at potential pitfalls, I look at two parallels to the 18-19 Celtics, which was another team that had lofty expectations, not just because Kyrie is, you know, was a part of both teams, but you had guys in Boston that going into that 18-19 season, you know, they said all the right things, whether it was Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Marcus Smart, they talked about sacrifice, putting winning above all else. And then the season started and it all kind of went downhill from there. There are some differences, of course. That team was coming off a trip to the conference finals where without Kyrie, without Gordon Hayward, they almost knocked off the Cavaliers in seven games. This team doesn't have that, but they've been a playoff team the last couple of years. And they've been guys on the rise, whether it's Dinwiddie, Caris LeVert, Jared Allen, Joe Harris, who just got paid. How big an issue? I know pre-pandemic, you like to be around these guys much more often. You like to be at practices where you can get much more of a feel for, you know, how guys are responding. But have you been able to glean anything about, you know, just how, I mean, how strong is that will to fit in and be part of something bigger than just putting up numbers? How big of a challenge is it going to be for the Dinwiddies, the LeVerts, and those are probably the two primary guys because they're more ball dominant than Joe Harris or Jared Allen. But how do you, what's your sense on that?
That's what leads me to believe that those type of understanding of roles or how you fit in or the sacrifices needed to make for this team and for what they aspire to be is why it will work. You pointed to the Celtics team, and I understand the comparisons, and I believe we may have talked about this in the past, but the point you make was what they achieved the season prior, you know, and how far they got and where they felt like that group and those players as individuals, but collectively were able to achieve. And I think this Nets group, whether it's Caris LeVert you look at or Spencer, they realized that it's really been a very nice achievement and in some ways early one when you look at two seasons ago getting into the playoffs. So that's not where they're trying to go. So they understand you need these type of star power players. And to me, and just having been around these guys, you know what players are saying, the things they're supposed to say and saying the right things. And you know when they mean it. And the personalities of Caris LeVert and Spencer Dinwiddie, and Caris in particular, because of everything he's been through, some of the injuries he dealt with early on, the respect level of being friends, you know, on the court and off the court with Durant and Kyrie Irving, with working out in the summers in many years past with Kevin Durant. So having a pre-existing relationship, and then Spencer Dinwiddie has showed that his entire career. You know, he's come in, he's played the role of starter, he's played sixth man, he's, you know, been putting up big numbers and then has been relegated to coming off the bench because it's been better for the team. And he has done all that with the same consistent amount of enthusiasm. So for those reasons, that leads me to believe that some of those issues that you may have naturally with a team won't exist. And even a guy like Joe Harris, he's not counting the number of touches he gets. He's not counting the number of shots he gets up. He's willing to do, he understands that will come. And I think because of it, you know, given the season and the unexpected nature of COVID, of what happens, of, you know, how this all goes along, I think we know that seasons can be long and different guys will need to be relied upon in different ways throughout the course of it more than ever in this upcoming year.
Yeah, and there isn't a Gordon Hayward in this mix either. And Hayward's recovery was a big part of the problem Boston had in that 18-19 year, kind of being forced to spoon feed him minutes that maybe he didn't deserve at the cost of other guys' minutes. And they took that, that rubbed some of them the wrong way as well. Where there is a, I think, pretty strong parallel is on the subject of trade talk. And look, James Harden screwed over the Rockets when he basically declared himself, you know, desiring to want out. I think he also screwed over the Nets a little bit too. I mean, by declaring his intention to, or at least, you know, not publicly declaring, but by letting it known that he wanted to play in Brooklyn, he created this whole trade dynamic, right? Like, and this is what existed in Boston for a couple of years, where it was, are the Celtics going to go get Anthony Davis? Like, is he going to be the guy they acquired? And everybody in that locker room knew that the front office had starry eyes for Anthony Davis. And I would imagine, unless Sean Marks is telling them otherwise, that players in the Nets locker room somewhat know that, you know, if they have an opportunity to go get James Harden, the Nets are going to do it, and the cost is them, right? Like, it's, you know, you're sitting there, like, James Harden's not coming for free. It's going to cost you Caris LeVert and Spencer Dinwiddie and Jared Allen. Like, it's going to cost a lot to go and get that player. That's one of my questions, too, is as the Harden chatter heats up, and it's going to heat up in the next couple of weeks. I don't think he gets traded anytime in the next week or two, but before the trade deadline in March, I think he is going to get dealt. As that happens, like, are these guys going to look around the locker room and be like, you know, does this team want me here? Like, or am I just kind of a placeholder for James Harden? As you kind of look at it from that perspective, how big a potential liability is that for the Nets this year?
I think with all teams and in all circumstances, that's always something that each individual handles different. And I think it can be, and we see this in many cases, it can be a harsh reality, particularly for young players if they've not been through it, to deal with the separation and the balance of, you're talking brotherhood, you're talking family, you're talking goals, but still a business. And at the end of the day, you know, that's the way that sometimes things work, in whether you're in trade rumors or speculation or whatever it may be, that's a part of the experience and learning of being in the league. And I think all players go through it. They go through it in a different capacity. What I will say to this point is I think there has been chatter. I think whether the Harden stuff is the most obvious, but whether you want to talk about speculations and not that he was ever on the table, but Bradley Beal last year talking about, do the Nets need a third star? I feel like to this point, this didn't come out of nowhere. And these talks, this concept from the time that Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving said that they were coming to Brooklyn, I think that is always in some way started to seep into the conversation externally and from the media and from things that these guys hear. So I think to this point, this is nothing new. And where I think the real test will be is, what is the communication of Sean Marks and of Steve Nash? And Steve has spoken about this throughout the course of the early part of training camp, because he's been asked, and he said, all we can do is be as expressive and communicative as possible to let these guys know how much we want them here, how much we value them. He addressed Spencer Dinwiddie the other day and just raved about his game and how much he values him here. And that's, I think, where, as we know, in this, there's that balance between saying these things, but also an honesty factor of you never know what may happen if the right deal is presented. So I'm not in those rooms. I'm not privy to those conversations in any capacity, but I do believe that in Sean Markson and Steve Nash, there was a level of why they are regarded so highly is because of the communication factor, because of the way they resonate and understand with players. Steve himself, having been a player and knowing in locker rooms what that can do, and the intention of, okay, do they know how to approach this? How do I handle this, especially with these individuals and these players?
Yeah, I mean, I buy that to a degree. I do think that Brad Stevens tried to do that, that Danny Ainge tried to do that. It didn't help all that much because whenever a trade rumor came up on the internet, you know, Jaylen Brown was asked about it, Jason Tatum was asked about it. I think Tatum even had to comment like something along the lines of, hey, you know, if I get traded for the best player in the world, all right, I'm traded for the best player in the world. So
do you think it matters? I'm curious, do you think it matters where those players were at? And we're looking at specific situations, but in terms of getting paid, in terms of where their contracts are at, in terms of the fact that, you know, Joe Harris just got paid, Caris LeVert in his contract. And I know that doesn't change a trade. But I'm curious if it changes with guys at different points of their career, if they've already been on, if they're already on to their second contract in some capacity, a little more settled into at least the money side of things or the contractual side of things of their career.
You know, I don't think so, because Marcus Smart was part of that too, and it irked him as well, and he already had a second contract. I just think guys... It's not groundbreaking to suggest that guys perform better when they feel like they're part of the team, when they're part of the fabric of the team. And if they're not, I mean, guys can talk about not being on social media all they want. We know they are, and we know that they look at this stuff and they talk to their agent about this stuff. It's just hard to block out, especially for guys in their early to mid-20s. So maybe these guys... it affects them differently than affected the players in Boston. I just know the players in Boston were affected significantly by it. It bothered them throughout. And these Harden rumors aren't going anywhere. Like, you know, I have no doubt that in the next few weeks and months, as other teams get into the mix, whether it's Philadelphia, Boston, even Golden State, I think could get there at some point. You know, you'll hear more about the Nets are willing to do this, the Nets are willing to do that. Like, you know, wherever it's coming from, it'll be out there. And, you know, maybe that comes down to locker room leadership. Maybe that's Steve Nash. Maybe that's Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving. Okay, that didn't go well the first time. But maybe it's that that is able to coalesce this locker room and have the us versus them kind of mentality that sometimes works, even if it is a little bit, you know.
Well, because I do think that there is something to be said, quite frankly, for there's front office leadership, there's coaching leadership, and to your point, there's players. And do you feel like the guy you're next to on the court, do you feel like the guy you're battling with every night has that belief in you, wants you there, believes that you are all in that together? I do think it factors in just as much as you're thinking about what moves the front office, the organization may make. More of it comes down to those individuals in the locker room and how that's part of the coalescing to me. That's part of the chemistry. That's part of, you know, it plays out on the floor, but that also matters what's happening in your locker room and how that comes together.
Is Kyrie not talking to the media more of a media problem, or is that like, I mean, it's just like, it feels like the first salvo from Kyrie to becoming a distraction. Like, it's just one of those things where, like, it bothered me to the, not that I cover Kyrie on a daily basis at this point, but, like, Kyrie is the most accurately quoted player I've ever covered. Like, he is accurately quoted. He is. And he is rarely taken out of context either. It's just that every time he says something, he can't stand when it's in print. Like, he just can't see seeing it. And, like, his own words being kind of pushed out there. I mean, it happened when it came to criticizing some of the younger players in the Celtics locker room for their habits early in that 18-19 season, which I know Jaylen Brown did not take kindly to at all in that season. The Brad Stevens stuff, how he didn't really get along with him. I mean, it's like, is this much ado about nothing? Or, you know, is Kyrie's kind of preemptive strike towards the media something that could fester?
See, I think it's much ado about nothing, just to the fact that you could look at it as a preemptive strike. I think that's, this is his view of these are the steps, the foundation I'm laying to try and do this the right way. And maybe there was missteps, and I don't know, you know, if there's, from his perspective, from anyone's, the shared responsibility about what's happened in the past, but I think in his mind, this is, okay, these are the steps I'm going to take to try and eliminate distractions for myself and focus on performing on the floor. And we know, talking to the media is a collectively bargained thing, like some of the details of when he talks, how he talks, getting fined, all that, that'll be sorted out. To me, I think it's how does this proceed moving forward in a general sense? I mean, I'm a member of the media, of course. We always want guys, especially stars, to be talking to the media. But from a perspective of just looking at it and the distraction or lack of distraction or what it is, the one thing I will say is at some point, if however long this continues, at some point then that responsibility, however you choose then to go about it, will fall on your teammates and fall on other players. So when it comes to leadership, when it comes to, you know, when games come around, when there's things to be discussed, like that's something to consider, because if you're considering yourself a leader of the team and in a leader in the locker room and all those things, that's a part of it. And so to me right now, at this juncture, the way it's moving forward, would people like to hear from him? Yeah. Do we think anyone other than the media is really too concerned with it? I don't really think so. But, you know, if Kyrie goes out and puts up another 50-point game to open the season and starts playing the way, I don't think fans, I don't think it's, you know, that much a issue in the broader sense of things. I just think as you continue on, you know this, if you're not talking to one player, you have to talk to another. And a lot of those questions are being redirected to your mm-hmm. teammates.
Yeah, no, that's definitely part of it. The, you know, asking Dinwiddie about Kyrie because he's friendly with him, like that kind of thing. It doesn't do anything, especially when, I mean, blowing off like the media day is so stupid. Like, you're not going to get anything more than, how's it like to play for Steve? What's Kevin look like? There really aren't these media.
I agree, but I think but you could also look at it from the perspective of then, like, what's the point? What am I going to say that you don't know? Like, it's all generalities. So here's my statement. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to play hard. I want to win a championship. I'm excited. There's other things happening in the world. Like that's where, to me, and I get to, I totally see the side you're saying.
You can't put COVID-19 as like the reason you're not talking to the media. Like you just can't. Like, all this happening in the world, I'm not going to talk about Steve Nash's offensive philosophies because of everything that's happening out there.
I agree. He didn't link the two. What I will say, is that Kyrie, throughout the course, especially the last couple months, but has done so much in terms of give back. And for the community, for the stuff he did in terms of the W, he has done so much, and he's done it without push for publicity, for fanfare, for show, any type of, hey, media, look at all this stuff. It's coming from a good place. It's coming. So to this point, I'm going to say, okay, this is how you approach it now, as it goes forward and as you continue on. How are you going to handle it? How are you going to approach it? I think that's where, you know, the real then questions will be.
He does a lot of that. And I give him all the credit in the world for doing the philanthropic things that he does. It's just like there's this disconnect in his head about, like, I say things and then people write about them and then I get mad at them writing about them. Like the greatest example is the whole... Remember when he was struggling at the end of the 18-19 season and he talked about how he called LeBron? Like, nobody brought up LeBron. Like, he just unilaterally brought it up and said, you know, I was having a tough go of it, so I called Bron. And everybody just, like, sort of pounces on that. He's like, whoa, 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 everybody calm down. Like, you brought it up! Like, this was your factoid you threw into the world. And now, obviously, it's like red meat to everyone sitting there in, like, the middle of January with nothing to write about. So... this just, right now, it's just a media problem that nobody cares about. Although I will say this to anybody the NBA is listening. I mean, you have to reinforce this stuff. Like, you can't be toothless about, you know, your media policies. You do that way too much. But right now, it's just a media problem. Maybe it evolves into something more than that down the line if he continues this, you know, Stacey Augment-esque strike of speaking to the media. All right, let me ask you quickly about the Russell Westbrook-John Wall trade, which, you know, reshapes the conference a little bit. Wall goes out, Russell Westbrook comes in. Pretty good deal in some ways for the Wizards, who only have to add one first-round pick in it to acquire Westbrook. Wall, despite the fact that he says he's all the way back, is coming off a major Achilles injury, has missed the last 2 years, or most of the last 2 years. He is 30 years old. I look at Washington, Sarah, as being one of maybe like a handful of teams. It might be like two or three where Westbrook could succeed at, because he has a coach that knows everything about him, that helped develop him into the player he became. Not just a stat stuffer, which he's become known for in recent years, but a point guard who in his early 20s led a team to the finals. Like, we can't forget that in 2012, Oklahoma City was in the NBA Finals. They might have had a chance if they didn't run into the buzzsaw that was the Miami Heat that year. So you've got a coach there. You've also got a second star in Bradley Beal, who is nowhere near as ball dominant as James Harden is. I mean, Beal, you know, certainly needs the ball and has become the face of the franchise the last couple of years. But James Harden had to have the ball in his hands to succeed, whereas Beal, because of his shooting, a little bit less. I mean, what do you make of the chances of success for Westbrook in Washington? And what does success look like at this point in his career?
I'm hyped for your boy, Scotty Brooks. Every time I think of Scott Brooks, I somehow link him to you, because he I feel like, is one of the few people similar to me that will always come on your podcast. I'm teasing. I'm very optimistic about this. I really like this, not just for Russell Westbrook, but also for Washington. And to your point, I think pairing him up with Bradley, I mean, Bradley Beal was a monster last year. It was incredible. I think that just it never translated to wins. There were injuries, a surrounding cast. Obviously, you know, with the way things turn out with the Wizards, I think it was often overlooked. And it's not just last year. I mean, I think the opportunity to pair with someone like Bradley Beal, who, you know, I don't think you can overlook the fact that they have their lifestyle, the approach to the game, the approach to preparation, how they work, all of those things, when you are in tune and in sync with that, I think it makes a difference. I think the fact that Russell Westbrook is going to have space to operate and the ability to play with, like, Davis Bertans there, but I know that was huge for Washington and a major emphasis to make sure to re-sign him. Like, the fact that you have him on the floor, everyone's really high on Denny Avdija.
I'm not even trying that yet. I'll get there.
The rookie.
Yeah.
I heard him do an interview, and he was really a lovely personality, and I'm excited to see his game if it matches that. But you keep going down. I mean, you got big man, rim runner that can get up and down, so it can go fast. Why is his
Thomas
name
Bryant?
Escaping?
Thomas Bryant. Yeah.
Yes, Thomas Bryant. Who I know there's work. You know, anytime you kind of talk to some people from Washington, they talk about the defensive end and they want him to rim protect better. But I just remember seeing, like, man, he can get up and down. He could run. So if you got Beal, you got Westbrook, that can push the tempo and pace, I think it's a nice fit. And I think at this point, for Westbrook to come to another location, and for what has been of the Washington Wizards organization recently, I think for him to contribute to a team to make the playoffs is going to be a step. Like, more for me, out of what you see of Westbrook, we've seen him be able to put up big stats and big numbers. I think he's elevated the play of those he's played alongside throughout the course of recent years. So it's less to me about that and more about, could you help translate this to wins for this Washington organization? And to me, that will be the test of how we would categorize success or categorize where Westbrook is at. Because I think you know what you're going to get out of him. I know he's getting older. I know so much of his game is predicated on athleticism and explosiveness and stuff, but more of it to me, he will raise the intensity level and the competitive spirit of this group. And I think for a team that has struggled finding ways to win, that has struggled in general, and how that affects your attitude, the mentality you come with every day, just how much of a challenge and a struggle it makes things in terms of mood, just by nature, because you're not seeing wins. that I think will just add to what this Wizards team is. And I'm excited to see them. I'm excited to see how this fits together. But I think, to your point, just the being reunited with Scottie Brooks and the other pieces on this roster, I think Washington's gonna be a team at least to keep your eye on.
Yeah, I'm an unabashed Westbrook supporter, and I'm perplexed at how people suddenly criticize his triple-double stretch. Like, at one point, that was like the unattainable goal, right? Like, Oscar Robertson did it and nobody else did. Now Russ did it 3 years in a row. I've said this before, but that to me is the Joe DiMaggio of, you know, basketball streaks. Like, that's never going to be touched. No player is ever going to average triple-double for 3 years in a row. It's never going to happen. They may never average triple-double in a season again, but they're definitely not going to do it for 3 years in a row. I might push back a little bit. I don't know that he elevates guys around him. I don't know that he did that in Oklahoma City post Durant. Not that he was, you know,
Paul George. You don't feel like Paul George.
Did he?
I will say that I think so. We were talking about Paul George being an MVP for a good portion of that first year he was there. I will say this before I let you finish with that. I think there's a difference between, we think about guys who, whether they're creating, they're playmaking, elevating level of play by what they're doing in terms of actually stylistically doing things. I think that Russell is part that, but more of it to me is just, he plays so dang hard and competes so hard in this, in every former teammate I've talked to him or current of his. It's not just, okay, you're watching this and it's a game, and yet he's absolutely busting his tail. But guess what? This is what he's like in practice. This is what he's like, you know, in the middle of the season on a Monday when no one else is in the gym. So to me, especially for some of these young guys, for a Rui Hachimura, who, you know, whoever that you're like, these guys, the atmosphere and the environment has not been that. And so how will that help just bring up the whole team? So I think there's two sides of talking about elevating the level of play of other guys.
No, I do agree with that. And most people that I've talked to as well have talked about the competitiveness and how that'll rub off on guys. Even a guy like Beal, I mean, who put up great numbers, but I think defensively slacked off some last year, especially as the season went on. And that can happen.
But that's what, like, and when you're not winning, like when you're not winning, when you don't feel like necessarily the surrounding roster is, you know, helping you to get those wins. Like that's where sometimes people point to that or point to defensive stuff. It's like, yeah, 'cause he's doing everything. And at some point it's just, I think that changes when you get the taste of win or you get the taste of those type of opportunities on that end.
I think the chemistry with him and Beal is the most important thing to watch. I mean, Beal has two guaranteed years left in his contract, a player option the year after that. This is kind of the year where they have to have chemistry. They have to get along, or else Washington is once again back in that place where they have to start exploring potential trades for Bradley Beal while he's at his peak value. And that's, look, they don't have a relationship. They know each other casually. So this is going to be the first time where they're, you know, kind of with each other and invested in each other. And how does that work on the court? How does it work off the court? That to me is the most interesting to watch. That's where I think Brooks can be a factor. One thing Scott Brooks did with Westbrook that Billy Donovan did not was he held Westbrook accountable. It felt like, and people in the Oklahoma City organization would tell me this, that, you know, Scotty would, when Westbrook kind of veered off into crazy town, you know, Scotty would be the one to rein him back in and to even discipline him at times and say things to him that maybe other coaches have not. When Billy Donovan came in, I think Russ, to a degree, kind of ran roughshod over that organization, and it wasn't as good as it could have been. So if you're able to do that, you're Scott Brooks, be able to rein Westbrook in when needed and to make make sure that chemistry is as good as it's going to be, that's a big factor in all this. So that to me is the big thing. Like, can at the end of this season, regardless of where the Wizards finish, you know, playoffs, out of the playoffs, if Westbrook and Beal want to play together, you've got the foundation there, because, you know, Rui's going to be better in year three than he was in year two, and the rookie this year is going to be better in year two than year one. Like, you've got some upside there in Washington. You just need those two guys to be on the same page.
And that's where I think just because they don't have a pre-existing relationship, it's not necessarily a negative thing. And that's where it goes back to me, to how they approach their preparation, their work, their attitude towards the game. If it, you know, both got kids, both, you know, these are different times of what players and people can actually do in terms of being social. But that's where I think in many ways, their lifestyle, their approach, and how they go about looking at the game, their perspective and preparing for the game aligns in ways that would give you hope that could be a real factor and that could be a real thing. By which they will enjoy playing together. They will mutually respect one another in those areas.
Well, if the Wizards, you're counting on it. That's for sure. You need them to be on the same page for your franchise, not to be, you know, fall back into the Stone Age, so to speak. Sarah, always appreciate it. If you need a keynote speaker at the Hall of Fame induction ceremony, I am available. I come up with some funny quips, some glib lines,
Any compliments? Anything nice?
I mean, that could be borderline.
After your speech, they're going to be like, "We retract our induction."
Well, if not the keynote speech, like, you know, put me next to CAA's Matt Kramer, and we can, you know, just we'll make the table the life of the party. How about that? Is that
Kramer's definitely excited. Kramer is. I don't know. You may be working out. You may be doing one of your workouts, one of your suntan beach towel workouts.
Okay. We're going to go back to mocking the bubble workouts. The bubble workouts were necessary for sanity, Sarah. You'd have been doing the exact same thing. You know it. You're as psychotic as I am. You've been doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, but I went to put it on the little green in social. Like, if you're going to share with everyone.
All these poor listeners that follow
you, they don't even know what we're talking about.
They don't. That's a good point. I did go green.
We're half public, half private.
On that note, Sarah, appreciate you joining me. Thank you.
Thank you. Stay safe.